The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Before that, I'm joined by Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda Commissioner and former Deputy Secretary General in charge of security. Was that the correct title? Was it Deputy?
Assistant Secretary General.
Assistant Secretary General in charge of security for the UN. John Lee, Executive Editor of the Daily Mail Group, that being Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday. And the very sad and depressed Larry Donnelly, dedicated Democrat and law lecturer at the University of Galway. Larry, we'll hold off talking about the American election for as long as humanly possible to give you a good run-up at it. Let's look at our own election and where we started with the Red Sea poll in the Sunday Business Post, because it sort of gives us a baseline figure of where we stand. I suppose the most notable bit of it is it's the first up arrow for Sinn Féin in a while. Good news for them. Larry, your take?
Well, yeah, I suppose, you know, given everything that's happened to Sinn Féin, I suppose anything is welcome, up 1%. But, you know, Fine Gael at 22, Fianna Fáil at 21, you know, pretty much in keeping with much of what we have seen. Some of the issues and the issues on which party they trust most is interesting. And it underscores where I think the big task for Sinn Féin is going to be in this election, which I think to some extent may be about damage control. But to a huge extent, I think their fortunes may depend on how well they are able to get housing front and center in the context of the campaign. That is the one issue where they have an advantage. They have an articulate spokesperson. So I think that's the task for them.
Well, this is interesting. John Lee, the breakdown of the issues, and we'll go into a lot of them, but there's infrastructure, environment, immigration, education, crime, job creation, the economy, and what's described in the caption as healthy, but what I think is originally meant to be health. The only one in which Sinn Féin ranks number one is housing, but it ranks number one by a mile, and we're told that's the main issue.
Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael's data, which I got a look at last week, shows that housing is still the overriding issue. But I wonder, is that 23%, this is just my speculation, a reflection of Ón Oibrín in many ways? You know, he's a very articulate, very popular spokesman. But he articulates a very, dare I say it, even in 4.5 years, a passé housing policy. I think he's a bit behind the curve on it.
Is it so effective? What this poll is saying is that 23% of people, by a country mile the largest number of any of the large parties, trust Sinn Féin to deal with housing, not Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil.
Well, it's 23%. It's a figure. There you go. I don't know. I don't know if that is enough for Sinn Féin across the board, if you know what I mean. You know, if you look at some of their housing policy, and they did get an easy enough ride in it, there are proposals in there that I put to Ón Oibrín at a press conference aren't exactly what aspirational people in Ireland have always declared they want. If that's the way they want to go, fine. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been involved in a 15-year dysfunctional housing market. Again, and you know, when I was out on the doorsteps yesterday with them all, and this is just my impression, there is somewhat of a feeling with housing, and I write this today, it's bad, it's really bad, but it's not as bad as it was under Leo Varadkar and Ón Murphy. So, yes, if housing as an issue can push Sinn Féin on, I'm somehow doubtful. As I said to you, I just found the mood among Sinn Féin canvassers and TDs yesterday and the day before, and I was out. It's very instructive when you're out with candidates, when you're out in the streets, is very downbeat.
Explain what you mean by it's very instructive. What insight is it that you get when you're out and about on a canvas that you don't get from polls, for instance?
You're talking to people on the streets. You're watching candidates. You're meeting Sinn Féin voters, for instance, on the street, and you know you can you can almost divine the language. And I'm 20 years of Polcord at this stage. If you say to someone in Sinn Féin, "How's it going?" "Oh, it's very positive," but people haven't quite made their minds up yet, which doesn't it just doesn't ring true with me. And you only have to look at the body language of the Sinn Féin leadership at their launch the other day. I just didn't think it was great. If you go back to 2020, for instance, a week into this, so we're not even a week into this yet. We're a couple of days. A week into the general election, speaking to people, speaking to candidates, you can learn as much from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael about Sinn Féin as you can learn from Sinn Féin. Fianna Fáil candidates, Fine Gael candidates were coming back to me saying there's something going on with Sinn Féin. We're not quite sure. The polls haven't indicated it because it was too late in the electoral cycle for that to happen. And it completely took off.
That but that sense of momentum, they could see it and feel it.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and I think that would have then hit the airwaves about a week, about 3 or 4 days before the general election that the political journalists, a bit later than me, of course, seemed to cop on to. I just don't get that right now. I had a look at Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's polling data last week and I went back to Sinn Féin about it. They have them at around 17%. That's in a territory now. It's, you know, it's 18% in the Red Sea today. That's a long way, and correct me if I'm wrong, from the 37% that they got.
Does the polling data that you saw from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, does it match what the Red Sea is revealing in the business poster? Is there significant disparity between them?
They're higher. Fianna Fáil have never been back to the... I remember PJ Mara used to give out to me all the time about the Red Sea. That's no reflection on the Red Sea. PJ Mara just didn't like it. He felt it didn't show up. Fianna Fáil support, they have themselves at between 23-24%. I gave it 23%.
Which gels with Micheál Martin. I mean, Micheál Martin on this programme, not to Red Sea specifically, but polling in general, he is always sceptical about how the polling reflects Fianna Fáil, and he always maintains that it is revealed to underestimate them.
Well, I think that might be down to maybe people who are polled are a bit embarrassed to say that they're supporting Fianna Fáil.
Still.
Going back to 2011. I think polling gets a tough press. You know, it's there as a guide. It's not, if polling was all 100% correct, we wouldn't have general elections. It's close enough. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are around 24%. That's not overwhelming either for parties that... But again, and then lastly in the polling, I would go back to the local and European elections. People often say they don't translate, but Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were around where you'd put them, 25% odd, almost exactly the same on seat totals. But Sinn Féin were 12%, but not only were they 12% the locals, they were 12% in the Europeans. Now, I've always felt that that's an extraordinary equivalence. That's not just a coincidence. That's where they are. Can they get momentum? And the momentum needed to be built from July. There was no media conspiracy. There was no establishment conspiracy. They went through nearly 6 weeks of hiding from the press, hiding from the media, having to deal with, and I'll be careful about how I say it, having to deal with the most appalling allegations about their staff, about now resigned electoral representatives. That is hardly a way to build and return your momentum to where you want.
Although they will doubtless be heartened then by seeing the up arrow. Larry, all of this leads to a lot of discussion in the papers about what the parties are doing in terms of promises and giveaways. We will get to that in 1 second. Before that, Noreen O'Sullivan, while we're talking about the breakdown between the parties, can you explain on some of this, because I'm baffled by it, how if we take a category like the economy, people can look at two coalition parties who are joined at the hip with a Fianna Fáil Minister for Finance and say Fine Gael is markedly better at dealing with the economy than Fianna Fáil. How are they deciding that?
Well, I'm not sure. I suppose we're all fascinated by polls and we like to watch them, and it's a fascinating sport coming up to any election. But actually, how relevant are they? And I think it goes back to what you said, Anton, and Micheál Martin's view. And particularly if you look at, obviously, housing is going to be an issue in this election and the economy will also be an issue, as we saw in the American elections. But at the end of the day, what policies actually transfer into votes is my question. And how does that actually work? And also, if you look at people like us and other political anoraks will look at manifestos in very great detail, but most people actually aren't really interested. They're interested in how it's going to relate to them. And I suppose, an example of that is, for example, News Talk host or newspaper editors, they put a lot of emphasis on actually within minutes, if not hours, after a show or after an article issues, you can find out how many people have clicked on it, and that's there. I wonder, and maybe somebody here can tell me, how many political parties actually look at their manifestos and put the same energy into looking at how many people have clicked and looked into their manifesto around the economy or housing.
Well, Holly Cairns will be with us in a while. We can ask her that when she comes in. Text say, if housing was sorted, so many other issues would be sorted too, so it should be one of the two main issues. I don't think Sinn Féin can solve housing any easier than any other party. The dysfunction goes back too far to solve overnight. I'm voting Greens first, as climate change and biodiversity loss is the most important long-term issue. We need a livable planet on which to build the housing we need. I'd like both of these solved to receive equal attention. And, well, interesting in terms of the Greens, because there's suggestions that the Greens are getting squoze out in favour of Labour as possible potential coalition partners. We will get to that in a sec. One other thing, Noreen O'Sullivan, that I wanted your view on. The proposition of Jerry the Monk Hutch running as a candidate for election and possibly becoming a TD. Did you think, going back to your previous job, that you would see it happen?
Probably not, but I suppose the positive thing is that it's good to see every citizen taking their civic duty and their responsibility in a positive manner. So actually, I suppose that's what our democracy means, is that anybody that wants to can step up and have ambition to enter politics.
Would you hope that there would be significant scrutiny of him as a candidate?
I think it would be very interesting to read his manifesto along with the other party manifestos.
To that issue then of giveaways, Larry, and promises, what are the main promises that we are hearing so far? The Sock Dems apparently are going to have 200 million set aside to revitalise Dublin. There's talk then of significant money going into housing from the various different political parties. What does it's heading for Late Late Show territory.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, and we hear now, you know, Fine Gael talking about the Apple tax money, you know, being used to set aside people to help get on the housing ladder. I think there's a very interesting issue, a very interesting context in which all of this is unfolding in terms of promises and in terms of taxes and in terms of expenditure. And that is actually going across the water to what happened in the United States and the potential things that Donald Trump has said he will do is America First agenda. And this comes to the point about the exchequer and how dependent we are on multinationals in terms of funding. And I think that responsible politics in this context mightn't be popular politics. The responsible thing to do would be for government parties and all parties to say, look, we are in a new territory here. We need to operate cautiously and hence to be more modest when it comes to, you know, pledges around expenditure, pledges around tax. But that doesn't make for good politics. But that is a very,
well, the
very...
the stuff that they're pledging, it's hardly Dionysian excess. I mean, this isn't the SSIA. Sinn Féin wants extra guards. Fianna Fáil wants the NTMA to be able to invest in infrastructure. The Green Party wants electric vehicle owners to have cheaper electricity. Labour wants to change the universal social charge. All of that is fairly responsible conservative stuff, isn't
well,
it?
That I suppose that's reassuring, but we are operating in a context, you know, we've had a giveaway budget, for instance, you know, and lots of things in there that I think we all liked. But I think that the responsible thing is for political leaders, for diplomats, et cetera, to be more cautious on these things. And I would hope that within the corridors of power, within the civil service, there is a sense that we are operating in potentially a difficult time and we need to act accordingly.
The worrying thing, I suppose, John, is that if this is only day one and a half of the campaign and there's already about £1.5 billion that has been spent between the main parties, where will we be in 3 weeks?
Well, I think I had elements of the Fine Gael manifesto in our paper this morning, and I think it's 10 days before they actually publish it, which will tell you how much of it there is to be leaked out there yet. And that the story we had isn't particularly costly, but it is indicative of where Simon Harris has seen quite a bit of success since he became Taoiseach, which is in tightening up immigration controls. That has showed up in Fine Gael's data as being the fourth most important issue for them.
And just explain the story, because the story that you have is interesting. It is it's a pledge, and this is your byline on the front page, a pledge to means test immigrants.
As was explained to me yesterday, if you are an international protection applicant, you are entitled to work. But you get virtually free accommodation. That is no longer going to be the case if you're working. If Fine Gael are in government, they're very firm about this. If they go into government, they will expect this of their partners, that they would be charged €238 a week for that accommodation. There has been talk of this in the past, and they have used charter jets before. They're getting their own charter jet. They're going to use that to deport illegal immigrants from Ireland, and the contract is to be signed next week.
And are both of these to act as a dissuasion for incoming immigrants? Is that the ultimate objective?
Simon Harris said publicly, if you listen to him, that and I'm sure you did, that you know, people aren't in Ireland anti-immigrant, but they want to see a system that works. They want to see a system that accepts legitimate immigrants and doesn't accept illegal ones. If I remember back to the time, I remember speaking to people in Fine Gael at the top of the party, there was criticisms when they were removing tents from the Grand Canal that they were coming back the next day, those tents. Fine Gael felt from their supporters and data that the public were happy to see something done. And again, in all the fallout from the United States, and I know we'll get to that later with Larry, I was in the United States last Christmas. I talked about it on this show, and I could not get over the visceral effects of illegal immigration in the United States. And it should also be noted that a lot of incumbent governments have fallen around the world. A lot of Western governments have fallen. And we are the only Western country, I'm sure someone might differ with me here, who has not seen their incumbent government seriously, seriously damaged by the immigration issue.
You're not in
there? That's yet to be, and they may yet be.
Yeah, I agree with John's assessment. The one thing I wanted to add is that I think Fine Gael has pivoted exceptionally shrewdly on the immigration issue in terms of not being anti-immigrant, but in terms of a policy stance and the things it's saying and the rhetoric. And it accords with what I think are middle class objections to not to immigration, but a sense that we're taking in too many people. We just can't handle it. This is all happening too fast. I think that Fine Gael is addressing those concerns especially adroitly. And I hear it all the time from people I talk to, people I meet at the golf club, for instance. They're on the same page as Fine Gael on this one. So I think they've moved in a really politically smart direction. And to some extent, they've taken some of that vote that might float elsewhere if they hadn't moved as they have.
Is it a very fine line? Because it is to say that we are not anti-immigration, but we are taking too many, is to suggest that there is a way to turn off the flow of people. If you have that many people coming into the European Union and we're saying we're taking too many, that is in essence saying we're not going to share our fair share of the burden.
I'm not so sure about that. I think it's just it's more a statement of reality. I think that's where a lot of people are coming from on this issue. The sense that what you hear oftentimes is we can't house our own. We don't have enough things here, and we've taken too many too fast. And we're not anti-immigrant, but we just need to bring things a little bit to. We need to have a conversation about this. How are we going to go forward? I think Fine Gael is addressing that concern.
A text to say, surely if people were going to put Sinn Féin into government by voting for them, they would have made up their mind by now after a decade plus of Fine Gael. Although the previous two elections would indicate that people can move fairly significantly both for and against. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and a few independents, that's the next government guaranteed. Well, briefly on that, John, the suggestions in some of the coverage this weekend is that both major parties are sick to the back teeth of the Greens, particularly the new iteration of the Greens under Roderick O'Gorman, and fancy the prospect of Labour as a junior partner.
Well, there is a belief that the Green Party is going to be significantly reduced after this general election. And if you look around the country and constituency battles come into 43 different constituency battles, you could see quite a few of them having problems. They only have six. Hazel Chew is actually seen as one of the favourites to hold back that tide and take Eamon Ryan's seat that's still with the party. Therefore, you'll be left with maybe a requirement for a third party. Fine Gael...
Only maybe.
Fine Gael, well, I have projections based on data today where the two parties between them could get 92 seats. That's a belief they have. That's a belief that their polling is showing up.
The Red Sea poll today isn't
a million miles away from that. The two of them are 43%, and in the past that would have given you an overall majority with enhanced. We also have a figure, for instance, that Green Party candidates in the local and Europeans transferred to a rate of 20% to Fianna Fáil. If we go back 10, 15 years ago, that was zero. So it is very possible that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael could form a government without a third party at all. I did get an impression. Micheál Martin said to me that in an interview 2 weeks ago that he would favour a third party, and he wasn't negative about Labour, that's for sure, whereas he was negative, interestingly, about the Social Democrats. So referred to them as rather utopian in their views, and he specifically, and this is Micheál Martin's way, he got a bit pedantic on it, if you don't mind me saying, that their opposition to the Canada trade deal was a big issue for him, and he felt that some of the leftist parties were not understanding of Ireland's trade position.
The other issue is, as we look ahead to the campaign, the security of the candidates, because we saw an instance already where Roderick O'Gorman was assaulted while canvassing, and there are reports that Éan O'Riordan, the Labour MEP, had a coffee flung over him and was then pursued around North Dublin for about 45 minutes by the individual in question. We will talk about that after this break.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by the deeply sad Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway and confirmed Democrat, John Lee, executive editor of the Daily Mail Group, and his front page story on the Irish Daily Mail this Sunday about Fine Gael's manifesto pledge to means test immigrants, and Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda commissioner and former assistant secretary general in the UN in charge of security. On the topic of security, one of the great advantages, I think, about our electoral system is how close candidates get to the electorate. They go around the towns, they knock on the doors, and there is a direct engagement. We've seen already reports that Éan O'Riordan has been assaulted. We've seen reports that Roderick O'Gorman has been assaulted. And we're only a day or two into the campaign. I assume from a security perspective, our system is a nightmare. It has to be very difficult to guarantee the safety of that many candidates.
It is very difficult, Anton, but it's also very important because, as you rightly said, our democratic system actually relies on, if some people would call it parish pump politics, but actually have an accessibility to your candidate, and equally candidates have an accessibility to the individual that's representing them. And most recently, I was asked to by the Ciarán Cóirle to chair a task force on safe participation in political life. And we examined the whole issue. But actually, what was most interesting, actually, was the level of abuse. And we did a comparative study right across the EU and internationally. And Ireland is following the international trend. And what we saw was that over 85% of candidates had actually been threatened or abused in the previous 6 months. And that's very significant. And then when you look at what are the drivers of that, both online and in person, and we found that it was driven by misogyny, racism, sexism, and increasingly xenophobia. So that hatred of the other. And it's something
So it is worse for women and minorities than it is for men?
It's much more, it's much worse. That's not to say, by the way, that men are not targeted. They frequently are. But there's a very sexualized and gendered aspect, particularly when it comes to women. And there's a conflation of issues then when it comes to women and minorities. So it's something that's very real. And actually, only this week, I was asked to speak at an All-Ireland conference in relation to the whole issue of what do we do to address it. So you can identify the problem, then what do you do to address it? That's why our task force made a number of very strong recommendations, because the issue is so critical to our democracy, not just the method of our democracy, but the heart of democracy itself. And some of those recommendations, as we have seen in the past, and particularly with the incident Roderick O'Gorman last weekend, there was actually a Garda Protection Officer had been assigned to him. So unfortunately, such was the extent of the issue that we had to make recommendations that actually, close protection officers have been reassigned to all government ministers. But also in the lead up to the...
Was there a period when close protection was gone for a lot of the ministers? Because it used to come with the car, effectively. You had a guard, the driver who functioned as a close protection. Was that largely removed after the economic crash?
Yes, after the economic crash, because I suppose it was interpreted that actually people were being given chauffeurs. And what was probably missed, quite honestly, was that these are close protection officers and that the need for that. But what we have seen because of the intensification of the threat and the abuse that people are receiving, and I want to be really, really clear as well, it's not about wrapping politicians up in cotton wool. We want our politicians to be able to speak for us and to be able to have healthy debate. But even the lead up to the local and European elections, actually, we had our recommendations were been worked on, but actually advice had to issue to local candidates and canvassers. And, you know, for this election as well, I know from my former colleagues, there's a lot of work going on in that regard. Advice has been provided in line with our recommendations. We also recommended that Commissioner Mann and Commissioner Chogan would issue advice and online safety advice as well to members and their staff.
And of course, but the scale to some extent, I assume, is the challenge, because back in the day, you had close protection for the cabinet. You then had additional protection, if I remember rightly, for Taoiseach Tonish to, I think, Justice and maybe Foreign Affairs as well. That's relatively easy to do. But if you have 166 TDs, if you have several hundred, if not thousands of people who are ultimately running for election, and in some instances, the opposition parties are subject to as much ire as are the government, how do you manage to give protection to that many?
Well, you know, just again, to be clear, so abuse is all parties and none, even independent candidates, because it's such a polarising issue. And some of the issues actually are non-issues, but nevertheless it is. So if what has to happen is then you have in each of the Garda divisions, there are crime prevention officers and there's a presence in each Garda division. And I suppose, to be fair, candidates are, we saw it at the local elections, we saw Tanya Doyle out in Dublin West and her husband, who were both reportedly assaulted on the trail. You know, we see canvassers all of the time. So actually, if people are increasingly talking about it, and I saw coverage during the week of new election candidates, but actually it's the reporting of it, and it's not just to look at capturing the prevalence, it's actually to be able to address it, and that those that behave in egregious behaviour have consequences.
But that's interesting, because there's reports in the papers today saying that the Gardaí have recommended to candidates that if they receive threats that they report them. And at first glance I thought, well, that's not a whole pile of use. What does it do? What good does it do you in reporting? But I assume, therefore, that is so that the guards and the crime prevention officers can look and see, is there a trend occurring? Is there a pattern? Is there something we need to engage on?
Exactly. And is there, you know, and sometimes there's something more sinister behind this. So it's very important to get a handle on this. There's individual incidents, but then there could be a pattern that actually indicates something more sinister. And particularly when it comes to social media, and I know we're going to talk about AI in a moment, but particularly, you know, threats online, and Commissioner Mann had the practice advice. But how do you moderate that? Harmful content.
There is a way of dealing with attacks on politicians and anyone, and that's to prosecute vehemently these people. And I'm a political correspondent. I work in Leinster House. I have not seen the evidence of that up until recently. Yes, Noreen's body has dealt with that somewhat. But let's not forget that the day of riots in this city a year ago, which I think amazingly and contradictorily has affected Sinn Féin, was accompanied by threats to politicians, was very, very ingrained in, had political issues running through it. There were a number of protests outside Leinster House at the time, and our paper carried very, very visceral criticisms of the Gardaí's passivity on all of that. You know, there are encouragingly a lot of court cases that have gone through recently where, as Noreen said, it's of every party. For instance, there was a woman, and, you know, online and harassment and stalking, etc., we know from all studies can lead to violence. I would say Jonathan O'Brien, the former Sinn Féin TD in Cork, there was a very, very serious incident there where a woman was convicted and sent to jail. Mary Lou MacDonald has made reports to the Gardaí about a very serious death threat. We've had Helen McEntee seems to be getting the most serious death threats every other week, and one man made
the bomb threat to our house,
but
it
was made from a jail. So, you know, yes, we can wring our hands about an awful lot of this, but there should be absolutely no toleration for abuse of a radio star like you. Or, and I've been on some TV programs and radio programs where there's almost this kind of element of, well, you know, the politicians, they put themselves out there. Nobody should be subjected to any of this. And it is up to the authorities to deal with it.
And I think there's a very good example of the riots in the UK, if we compare to what happened here, and how swiftly the courts dispensed justice to those that were actually arrested and charged. And I agree with John. I know there are more than 10 arrests, I believe, already this year in relation to attacks on individual politicians. And, you know, again, the whole criminal justice system has to kick in here. But also, I think there's a responsibility, there's a civil responsibility as well for people, all of us, to call out the behaviours that are unacceptable. As John has said, nobody, irrespective of their job, should have to tolerate abuse. And if we have people that are courageous and ambitious enough to stand up, to stand for election and to represent all of our interests, therefore, we all have a role in actually calling out that abuse is not acceptable in any form.
And of course, one thing that your task force looked at was, you know, what is it that fosters and promotes the kind of environment that this occurs in? One of it, of course, was social media and online interactions where this can sort of bubble along beneath the surface. There's a piece in the Mail on Sunday, Larry, I might get your view on it, about headlined, "When Seeing is No Longer Believing," in the run-up to the election, an expert warns it's too late to halt the proliferation of AI-generated deepfakes now. The search for truth is a lost cause.
Yeah, it's deeply worrying. I mean, the amount of information that we all have instant access to, you know, real information, disinformation, misinformation, it's deeply, deeply troubling. And some of it is quite sophisticated and believable that could trip up even the most savvy among us. You know, how do we address it adequately? I'm just not sure. I will say two things. One is, I think that there is, we talk about rights, but I also think that we have responsibilities as citizens. And even though I know it can be difficult, I think we all have a responsibility to be informed, active, engaged citizens. And that means not falling for every trick. That means looking behind something that if it seems too good to be true, then it isn't. So for instance, you know, Taylor Swift didn't really endorse Michael Healy Ray, you know, so you can't fall for some of that stuff.
There's a good example of it, Larry, because that's one where when we think about deepfakes, we say, well, it is going to be overt and a clear attempt to make it seem as if somebody is endorsing you when they're not. But Taylor Swift, the use of the deepfake for Taylor Swift, while nobody may have believed it was Taylor Swift, it was still a use of her image and likeness to further a political end.
Absolutely.
And an effective one.
Absolutely. And that, in a way, that brings me to my second point, which is particularly when it comes to social media, one of the issues, and I've talked to lawyers on both sides of the Atlantic for social media companies, and one of the issues here in terms of social media and the use and abuse of social media is you have, on the other side of the Atlantic, you have an absolutist view of what's allowed and basically anything goes. Because of the First Amendment that we as lawyers are all indoctrinated in, whereas you have a very different understanding of the limits of freedom of expression as it's referred to here. That tension continues to play out. But in terms of the legal battle, the First Amendment side seems to always win. And that's why we see social media being abused to the extent that it is. And people here are aghast. But if they want to know the reason, it's because the lawyers who are making the calls in these things have an absolutist view of free speech.
But surely there has to be even in the American context, sure, we know there is in the way that the social media giants operate. There is a difference between free publication and free speech. The Constitution does not enshrine your right to put anything you want between the pages of a newspaper or magazine and fling it at people.
Yeah, and you know that's the whole debate about, you know, are these publishers or not? You know, who is the publisher? Is the publisher the person who posts, or is it the social media outlet? And that's another debate.
What do you do in terms of covering of all of this, John? When you see deepfakes, do you call them out and thereby give attention to them? Do you ignore them? Do you believe it is going to be an issue?
I'm not sure if we know yet how effective all of this, you know, in the hand-wringing, I use that phrase again, the United States amongst liberals, there's an awful tendency to blame social media for a lot of it. I'm not denying that. I just don't think we know. Like, I know, for instance, you know, we've newspapers, we have a very, very substantial online output of the Daily Mail with both extra.ie here and the Mail Online internationally. We are somewhat reliant on social media companies. I think the Mail for distribution. I think the Mail has been one of the few international organisations that has taken on Facebook and Twitter and the others in the courts over the holds they have on the news. So what I'm saying is the AI, I'm not sure if we've got a finger on it. Yes, we cover it, but there are other issues going on when it comes to freedom of speech, when it comes to social media companies, i.e. how they distribute news. They choose how to do it. And I'm only going from what, you know, our former CEO, Rich Carpiola, said recently, that we're relying somewhat on what are they called? The
algorithms.
Mm. And they can change overnight. We have no understanding of why that happens, and it affects our business hugely. So there is a tension between old news companies and the social media companies. The result in the United States does not indicate there's going to be much of a clamp down there. But I'm only going
that tension, because it does, it sort of, it backfeeds into traditional media. If you know that something that you post as part of the Daily Mail online is likely to go viral or do well, there is a commercial imperative to feed that machine to some extent, I assume.
Yeah, but I see, this is again my interpretation of what I've seen our company executives say publicly. I don't think we've much control over it. That's the problem. We don't know how a lot of this is controlled. I mean, the lack of knowledge of how social media companies with massive sweeping powers operate is extraordinary. So what I'm saying is we're reliant somewhat, but it's not an equal relationship here. We have no call over how Google, how Facebook, how Twitter distribute our news. And then you've no call from another section and take ourselves out of it. You've no impediment to Twitter, for instance, as we've seen during this general election in the United States, putting whatever they like out there to favour a candidate. And they are beyond control. Joe Biden had made some inroads into dealing with trusts in the United States, which is what essentially these outfits are. And
but that that's where the long bolted now with the election. Yeah.
But I think we may have an opportunity in relation to that very quickly. I'll just say, you know, Michael McGrath's role, for example, in the EU and the Democracy Shield. And I think it's actually a very important role. And if he is confirmed as the Commissioner for Democracy, I think that's a very good job, a very good opportunity, because let's be realistic here. Technology shapes society. And the reality is actually that we all have to learn to live with it. AI is there. And I think what we have to balance, as everybody here has said, is those rights, the freedom of expression, but also then misinformation, disinformation, and what that means in terms of the impact on our democracy and on all of our futures.
If you view 53106 at a cost of 30 cents or 087-1400-106, text say, your journalist should ask, why are people so angry? The answer is nobody in government reflects what the people of Ireland want. Our voices are not being heard and the media is avoiding the real issues. On that topic, Larry, after the break, a lot of the coverage of Donald Trump's election has been to look at how the Democrats lost it. I would like your view on whether or not it is finally time to come to terms with the fact that America, and particularly white America, that's actually what they want and reflects the reality of the country. We'll get that after this break.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Well, there's a lot of coverage, unsurprisingly, of the new president, or the president-elect, that being Donald Trump. The Business Post saying Trump win thanks to Democrats failing to learn the 2016 lessons. Larry, you've obviously, I assume, been having a long, dark night of the soul for the last couple of days. What lessons is it that need to be learned out of this? Because there is a little bit of me, the more I look at it, that says, I think the lesson we all have to accept is that this is actually not, Trump is not causative, he's reflective. That's America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've long thought that Trump was not, you know, the creator of all of this. He was merely a symptom of it. And I've spoken before on this program and elsewhere about, you know, my own view that the American model is broken, that, you know, there's widespread doom and gloom for a whole host of reasons, that the income inequality is palpable in the United States. And into that context, you have somebody like Donald Trump, who's great at proposing simple solutions for very complicated problems, and has been something of a savior for people who feel like politicians haven't been talking to them or meeting their mood in a long time. And whatever his flaws, Trump has done a remarkable job, at least on that front, of connecting with them.
Because I've gone down a total rabbit hole in terms of looking at the demographics, and I'm stuck with something, which is, effectively, the Democrats have been shorn up for a long time by black people and Hispanics. If it wasn't for black people and Hispanics, a Democrat wouldn't get a look in. And what we have in this instance is the vast disproportionate support they get from ethnic minorities has waned ever so slightly. And white America has been allowed to be in charge. And white America wants what Trump sells.
I'd argue with you if you say it's moved ever so slightly. I think the biggest story in American politics for the past decade has been the shift of Latinos, the fastest growing voter group in the United States, to the Republican Party. It is absolutely extraordinary.
But they're still majority Democrat, albeit slightly, but still majority.
Very
Democrat.
Slightly, but I expect on current trends, I expect that to actually change, and I expect the Republican Party to be the choice for Latinos, especially as they move up the ranks. They're actually going to be far more like Irish Americans than they are like African Americans in terms of their voting preferences. And here I'll tell you, again, something I've been banging the drum on in a long time, what's wrong with the Democratic Party, the party, as you say, that I've belonged to and that my family represented in different levels of elected office for many, many years. And they'd be turning in their graves if they saw what the Democratic Party has become. It has become a party of identity politics. It has become a party of hard left social policies, so much so that there was an abortion ban outside the Democratic National Convention. My great uncles and my uncle would be sick if they heard that. And that is how we're identified. And then on the flip side, moving away from the cultural issues, which has cost us the white working class and has now cost us Latinos. If you look then on economic issues, at the behest of big money donors, our party has moved in a corporatist direction. We have moved away from blue collar workers, which is extraordinary to me. And that started really when Bill Clinton signed on to the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was a disaster for working class America.
The one thing that I can't quite understand from a Democrat perspective is the difficult, the sort of the coffin corner they find themselves in. For instance, you have 8 out of 10 LGBTQ plus people vote Democrat. If you move away from issues of gay marriage, for instance, which is one of the things that a lot of the core Republican white male middle-aged rural vote would want, well, you alienate that core block. If you move away from issues to do with reproductive rights, you alienate another of your core blocks. So how do you satisfy the white, rural, middle-aged, middle-class America that is predominantly Republican without alienating your own vote?
You put your finger on something very important there. I think we have to look at the example of Bill Clinton, who was an extraordinary instinctual politician. And I'll sum it up for you very, very quickly like this. Even words mean a great deal in politics. And what we heard on the abortion issue, and I'll take this one on because it is the one issue where Democrats do have an advantage in terms of the culture wars, right? I think they're vastly outweighed by Republicans on just about everything else. But I'll take the abortion one on. And they had Democrats had an advantage in this election, but they arguably booted it away by over-egging it. And it comes down to what you just said a minute ago, referring to abortion all the time as reproductive rights, as reproductive freedom. When you talk in such virtuous terms about abortion, something that even people on the pro-choice side in the United States have deep issues with, they're not comfortable with. These are the voters we need to win. We're always going to have the pro-choice people. They're always going to be in the Democratic Party. But the people who are in the middle, the people who decide these things, the people in middle America, you alienate them. You repel them when you use language like that. And this is where I'll go back to Clinton. Clinton said, safe, legal, and rare was his formulation. That met the mood. It kept the cultural left on side. But at the same time, it said to Americans who are uncomfortable with it, look, there's a place for you in this party as well.
But do you think, Larry, and accepting that very well-made point, do you think it is possible to coax back that evangelical, white, middle-class, or working-class, non-college-educated, Fox News-watching, gun-owning cohort?
Not all of them are reachable. That's absolutely true, that not all of them are reachable. We've lost some of them forever. But what we do need to do is win back some of them, and we also need desperately to stop the bleed of Latinos who are going to be a bigger and bigger cohort of the electorate. We need to bring them back.
You know, you could, I think you can make Larry feel a bit better by remembering only 4 years ago, this guy was beaten. You know, we're inclined with elections to throw our hands up. Well, I know Larry isn't doing this. I'm not saying he is.
But because there was a bigger black and bigger Hispanic vote. White vote hasn't moved.
To throw our hands up. You know, there were serious, serious impediments to the Democrats returning. There were an unpopular administration. Inflation, far more so than it does in the United States, in Europe, I think, has a huge effect on how people stand. Joe Biden was clearly not capable of standing. I was in the United States last January, and anyone I met said the man then was incapable of standing. He it's very hard to remove a president. Considering the size of that country, I think Kamala Harris was given a hospital pass and that she'd very little time then to campaign properly. You know, the stars aligned for Trump in some ways, but even if we have a fundamental redrawing of the map in the United States has survived that before. Larry's party, as he'll tell you, the Democrats dominated the South up until 1968.
Entirely dependent on the black vote. They get 9 out of 10 black voters, and they are to some extent entirely dependent, at least they were the last time they won, on the Hispanic vote, and it's leaving.
I just wonder, though, you know, Trump is a phenomenon. And he gets away with things, as we all know, and you've heard this ad nauseum, with things that no other politician will get away with. And what has happened doesn't make him a good man. What has happened doesn't make the United States a country populated with bad people. I think it's an election. The Democrats lost it. The Republicans won it. This guy will be gone in 4 years. And let's see where we stand there. Yes, if some of the warnings Larry is making are going to come to pass. I think we'll only know after Trump. Will the Republicans return to normalcy? Does Trump's tendency to be absolutely obnoxious, not a tendency, the fact that he's a convicted criminal, does that affect politics long term? I'm not sure if it does.
But isn't the lesson for the Republicans, the only way that you can continue to get elected with the success that you had is if you keep that cohort that Trump, the old Tea Party cohort that he brought within the fold, they now need them.
But I just wonder, is he, and I've always felt he is a unique phenomenon, and I think a lot of political analysts will tell you this, this is Donald Trump. I'm not sure if J.D. Vance can be the next Donald Trump. I'm not sure that anyone in the world would sit and listen to a fella going on about sharks getting an electrocution.
I'm watching Larry's expression to see is there any hope in his eyes.
I watched him the other night. He spent 15 minutes talking about Elon Musk's rocket. So let's see if that phenomenon continues. But the United States, you know, it's a formidable place.
Last word to you, Larry Quick.
To John's point, I do want to end on an optimistic note, which is that if Trump pushes hard and can't deliver for working class people, and I suspect he's going to have a real problem with that, Democrats could have a very good midterms in 2 years.
Larry Donnelly, John Lee, Noreen O'Sullivan, thank you all very much.